That's a new thing. That's a new thing they've added into what is this program? Zoom, where it tells you that it's being recorded. And I noticed it the other day when I was in a meeting with Laser, who were doing an interview, ironically, about what we're about to talk about. And it just came out of nowhere. And I was like, what the hell? Being told that the meeting's being recorded. I don't know if it comes out in the recording, but I guess we'll find out. It might say this meeting's being recorded at the start of it, and I might not edit it out because I think it's kind of amusing. Anyway, so it is the 8th of June. It's a Tuesday, and we're just over a week ago that I rode from Land's End to Ness Point. And similarly, in the past, how Emily from Atticus, who's on the actually much closer to me now, to be fair,
Yes.
still north, but closer north. We've done like a podcast which was talking about the trenching challenge or 107 TDF, just trying to like summarize it. So I think it's quite, I get asked lots of questions about these kind of challenges, like I've said in the past. So it's a really easy way for me to do it is to do it as a podcast with Emily, because Emily's fantastic as sort of running that and interviewing me. I'm not an it, I'm a me, about the challenge and kind of what happened. So I'm gonna basically let Emily run this episode again, to be perfectly honest.
Cool, thanks. Hello.
Hello.
Morning. All right. It's about a week after, isn't it? You're still kind of a little bit beat up, but feeling more human. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'm a little bit. I'm not 100%, but I would say I'm probably like 90%. I'm a bit fragile, a bit sore still, and I think a lot of it also comes from the fact that I decided to have my first COVID vaccination on the well a week ago today. So my body was already on like trying to recover from this challenge, and then go and shove a load of microchips in my arm, you know, satellites, whatever it is that people think it is. A joke, incredible feat of medicine, to be perfectly honest. This is the whole thing with when you have the vaccine, you're putting a small dose of the virus in you, so you're building up the immunity. So I think the combination of being fucked from riding the across the country and then having a vaccine probably was like a double whammy on my body and immune system. And that's pretty much, I think we spoke on the phone on like Thursday, maybe Thursday or Friday last week, while I was driving to the recycling center, and I was feeling very rough. It's probably only been then sat it was Saturday, I felt quite a lot better. Sunday I felt awful again, and yesterday I felt pretty good, and today I feel all right, a little bit fragile still, but I'm okay.
Bit more human.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, let's crack into it then. So, first of all, let's kind of can you explain what the challenge was and I guess why you were doing it?
Yeah, so the challenge was effectively to ride from England's most western point to England's most eastern point. Both are places I've ironically visited before in the 107 TDF. So it's kind of nice to go back to them. I'd not ridden it the basically west to east. I'd kind of gone from London to Land's End. So I kind of knew that section going that direction. And then I've obviously done from Ness Point to London. So I kind of knew that bit as well. But I've not done it as a complete ride. Originally, the plan was to do this towards the end of Testicular Cancer Awareness Month, which is a month that Movember do a lot of promotion about, obviously, because of the work they do with testicular cancer. And talking about the campaigns are called like Know Their Nuts, the Nuts and Bolt campaign. And the idea was to use it as an opportunity to help create a conversation about men's bollocks, because there's a bit of a stigma about like being open and talking about it, like I guess like any sexual organ of a person. It's something that doesn't really get talked about much. But the big thing for me was testicular cancer is very common in younger men. And what I mean is like 18 to sort of 35, that kind of age category, which I know is my primary audience, to be perfectly blunt. So for me, it was an opportunity to try and create a bit of awareness about that, how to check out your nuts. If you find anything is a bit not normal, bit of pain, bit of discomfort, to then have the confidence to go to a doctor or a hospital to have it checked and made sure it's okay. And for me, that became a success when I had about three or four guys message me saying, I've gone, checked myself out, found something I wasn't too comfortable about, or wasn't sure it was right, and I've gone and got a checkup. So that to me, that's box tick. The whole challenge is a success from that. And then I think what happened is the challenge kind of changed a bit, completely out of my control. And as I'm sure most people listening or watching this know, there was an incident that happened on the challenge and the first attempt of it, where, it's pretty open, basically got kind of attacked on the bike in the middle of the night. And it made me feel shit, really shit. And not just physically shit, I was quite shaken up by it, but also mentally really quite broken by it. And I was talking to Ozzy, who is my, like, I don't really know how to describe him, but he's the my point of contact with Movember. And he's also like he's definitely become a firm friend of mine as well now. And he's very sort of good with advice and that kind of thing. And he said to me, he basically said to me, like, as shit as the incident is, you need to work out a way of turning this into a positive thing for yourself more than anything, as opposed to a negative, because it will help you. So my way of doing that was just very openly and bluntly speak about what happened and how it made me feel. And I think a lot of people kind of associated with that openness and honesty. I'm 5'11", I'm not short. I normally have a beard or some form of facial hair, happens to be a mustache at the moment. I think I've got fluff on my chin as well. I did have some fluff on my chin. And I, covered in tattoos. So like, traditional stereotyping, there's probably a perception that I would be maybe a bit of a, a bit of a man about this kind of stuff. And being open and honest about how it made me feel and genuinely made me very scared. And to the point that I wasn't particularly comfortable riding outside or anything. I was hoping that that would help other people to kind of like open up that discussion about masculinity, emotions, feelings, making a point that it's absolutely fine to be honest about how you're feeling about a situation. And same thing for me, that became a success because there was an unbelievable outpour of messages from men, women, cyclists, non-cyclists, local residents to Andover, cyclists in Andover, the police. There was a huge outpour of people who related to the message and how I was feeling, were genuinely very saddened about the incident and what happened in their town or somewhere where they cycled through or grew up. Or for example, with the police, it was they were genuinely very mortified that it happened, full stop. And I think what frustrated the police the most was the fact that they were not able to actually do anything. So instead, this challenge became something which was primarily talking about testicular cancer, to being much more open and talking about men's mental health and vulnerability, I guess. And it led on to, and equally that vulnerability, men's mental health, men's, mental health awareness, all that kind of thing is something that's so pivotal to what Movember do. They do this campaign, which is called ALEC, talking about ask, listen, engage. Fuck, I can't even remember it now. Reach out, again, something like that. Anyway, I can't even spell, so I don't even know what way around it is. But anyway, there's the ALEC campaign, which is all about how you talk openly and discuss with people who might be at risk. So, you know, the idea came up. The whole challenge is being supported by Shimano, which I'm incredibly thankful for, and very lucky to get to work with Shimano and have done now for quite a few years. And I pitched the idea to them about filming it and creating a documentary about it, and they were 100% behind that, which is incredible. It's really, really cool. And I pitched who I wanted to film it, which was Andy, who filmed the 107 TDF challenge and is a very good friend of mine, and we work really well together, and they were 100% on board with it. So after the first attempt, we had a phone call with Shimano, Andy and myself, and this discussion came up of like, what do we want to do? And the Shimano sort of said like, it's completely your call. We're not going to force you to do it again. If you don't want to do it again, we can make something very compelling out of what's happened as a story and turn it on a positive spin, 100%. But they're very clear they didn't want to make it a negative kind of bad story thing, which I completely understand. And this is the right decision. And they said, or maybe, and we were trying to like battle around ideas. And it was like, just not do it again. Carry on, as in start from Andover and continue, or start the whole thing again. And we were chatting away, and I just sat there and I pretty much went, fuck it, let's just do it at the end of May. And everyone was a bit like, what, really? And I was like, you mean like start from Andover, don't you? And I was like, no, we had to start from the beginning at Land's End and do the whole thing again. And I remember Andy was just like, are you being serious? I'm like, I'm 100% being serious, because I set out originally to do the whole thing. So we're going to redo it by doing the whole thing. It's not the same challenge if I did half the challenge. And I just said end of May. I forgot that bank holidays and school holidays exist, basically. And ended up realizing that it was the bank holiday weekend. But so it gave me that opportunity to kind of like, I guess, think about what I'd done. I'd still cycled 400 kilometers in like 15 hours. That's pretty damn good going. Kind of decompress from it, retweak some of the route, which I inevitably did. Not to go around Andover or anything, which I did look at doing, but I retweaked the route to basically refine a few sections where there were roadworks, for example. The original route went north of Dartmoor National Park on a huge section of roadworks, which was like, they just put like gravel down on the road, and it was really not pleasurable to do, and sketchy as fuck to ride on. And then you end up on a cycle lane which runs at the top of Dartmoor National Park, which is very beautiful, crosses over, it's like an old railway train and crosses over a bridge, but is very slow. And so the big change was basically going, okay, currently we're going north of Dartmoor National Park, which is slightly flatter, but it is slower, or it is slow, and it is longer. Let's just go straight through the middle of Dartmoor. Massive hill, but also with a massive hill is a massive descent. So that was the main change I made to the route. And then there was a bit of road which had like some beautiful hairpins on it, switchback hairpins, and Andy was just like, let's just drop that in anyway. Not me thinking, I'm not going to get there till the middle of the night anyway, so I'm not going to see any of it, but added that on, and it ended up making it the same distance, to be perfectly honest, as it was originally. So yeah, I guess I kind of got on a bit of a tangent there, but the challenge was initially to ride from the most western point to the most eastern point of the UK in as kind of a straight a line as possible. So straight as the crow would fly as I possibly could, and to open and to use it as an opportunity to discuss originally about testicular cancer, but what in turn became quite more heavily focused about mental health and understanding that it's okay to be open about feeling nervous and scared doesn't matter who you are or what the situation is. And then, you know, having the almost that for me to commit to doing it again was almost as hard as being open about the situation and the challenge, to actually just go, fuck it, let's just do it again. And that became a mental battle in its own right during the second attempt, was dealing with that and riding effectively the same roads. But yeah, long and short of it, it was all about men's health.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was interesting how it did change. Because I remember watching along, I think just on your Instagram stories, it was a day when I'd got up really early for some reason. I remember seeing something and messaging you, and you'd message back. And I think it was the point after you had stopped at some point. So you rode through Andover on the evening, didn't you? And obviously the incident happened, and then you continued to go for a bit. Is that right?
Yeah, so the incident happened, and I continued to basically, I continued on to the next town, which is where the film crew were. And that was kind of when the call was made, because I was visibly very shaken. I basically got off the bike, and the guys were like, are you all right? And I was like, no, I'm not all right. And explained what happened. And at the same point of this, and massive like respect to Andy for having the courage to basically, well, for a few things, the two guys filming was Andy and Ed, and massive respect to both of them for, first of all, Ed straight away grabbing the camera and pressing record, and Andy straight away coming up to me and giving me a massive hug and basically going, I don't think you should carry on. I think we should stop for the night and sleep, because we had a caravan. Caravan. I think we're bed in it. Basically going, we should stop for the night and then reassess it in the morning.
So they weren't with, was anyone with you at the point that it happened? No.
No one was with me, no. So the slight irony of the whole incident was, and I kind of, it's like, I think now in hindsight, I kind of can laugh at it a little bit, was that the route ended up cutting into a park. Bad planning from my side. And it was a park that ran along the main road. So I could have stayed on the road, but I was absolutely busting for a piss. I said this to the police officers. I was like, I know you probably don't want to hear this, but I was absolutely desperate for a piss. So I cut into the park to go for a piss. There's no public toilets or anything around. Like, when you've got to go, you've got to go, quite frankly.
And you don't want to leave the bike outside if you're on your own.
Exactly. And I didn't exactly want to go for a piss on the side of an A road. A bit weird. So I took that opportunity to go for a piss, cut into the park. And it happened while I was riding back out of the park, basically. I think it was like four or five guys with a couple of dogs. How I perceived it, which could be very different to what the actual incident was, but how it was to me was, bunch of guys coming up to me with dogs barking. One guy comes very close. They're all sort of heckling and shouting shit, probably drunk. One guy comes up to me in an attempt to push me off the bike. Two hands on my side, goes to push me. In the process of that, I managed to unclip my left foot to stop myself falling over. During this very short period of time, it's a lot of laughing and heckling and sort of shouting and jeering, all that kind of thing. Hence, I feel like they might have been drunk. And I managed to then get back on the bike and get going as quick as I could. It probably was like 2 minutes, very short and quick. But it's enough to, you know, someone who at that point would say, I've been up since 4:30. It's about 10:30 at night. I'd ridden 400 kilometers. I was fragile, both physically and mentally at that point. And I know me, that riding into the night, that's always tough. It really is tough. So it really shook me up, but I managed to basically get on the bike pretty quickly, kind of ignore, try and get out of my head as much as I could. But I was, you know, I was pretty shaken up by it all, and get out of the park and back onto the main road. And
yeah.
So with the guys filming, what we kind of had was they would always be, what they would always be in pretty close proximity, like within a couple of kilometers before or behind, or sometimes they'd be driving behind or driving in front. But generally, especially in the evening, it was like, we'll go up ahead, go up the road a little bit and wait for you to come past, and then we'll go on and just follow on like that. And it just meant that those guys could get a bit of downtime as well, because they'd been up the same amount of time. They'd been driving a van around, like, equally tired. What they were generally doing during the challenge was having, like, alternating who's driving, so one can have a kip, and also during the daytime, having a kip in the daytime. So it definitely helped them out a bit. But yeah, we rode on to the next town, and that's when the call was made to stop. And you know, I've done enough of these things that you should never completely, like, stop the challenge or ride at night. You should never do it, because it's the worst time. But you can obviously sleep on it and then wake up the next morning and make the decision. So we ended up sleeping in this really weird little lay-by that had loads of bins in it. Don't know why, but like loads of big bins. It felt like being set like at one of the lay-bys in like Calpe or something, which is just like everyone's residential bins are there. But we ended up sleeping there. I woke up the next morning like super early, like 5 o'clock or something, just because it was light and my body was like, let's get up. And I said to Andy, I was like, oh, maybe we should ride to London. And then if I finish in London, it's like, that's kind of a point. It feels like it's much more of a thing. And like my mind's just trying to think of like, how can I make this actually still work as a project? And I like continue worrying that, you know, Shimano, for example.
Feels like there's a lot on your shoulders almost. It's not just a ride with your mates, or it's not just a thing that you're doing. It's kind of almost, there's an inherent pressure with being you and having sponsors and having people that you've told that you're going to do right, and even people following the ride. I imagine there's a sense of kind of responsibility almost to perform.
Yeah, massively so. So I was like, oh, maybe if I continue to London, it's like, that's a finishing point and it sounds a bit more legit, and then call it there. And then Andy was just like, what's the point? Just stop and we can all do it. And I think him being so open about it like that made me go, no, you're right, actually. There's no point. Like, I'm probably not going to be very comfortable or confident riding from where we were to London, because that's basically, that stretch is shit. You're running into London, it's just shit roads. You're going kind of through Surrey, and then you're basically coming in like through Heathrow Airport, and it's just crap. It's just not enjoyable. Yeah. And so I thought, okay, you're right, let's just stop. And we drove back to Bristol, popped into like a service station, got some breakfast. And the reason why we drove back to Bristol was that that's kind of where we all congregated to start. So because Ed lives in Bristol and Andy lives in Brighton and I'm in the Peak District, it was about equidistant for Andy to get to Bristol, me to get to Bristol, and then for us to drive down together to Land's End. Obviously, on the way back, really fucking long drive, but it worked out as a good sort of start point to meet. So that's why we ended up driving back to Bristol. Andy then drove back to Brighton and I had a shower and everything and ended up driving back home.
Mm. Yeah, I remember speaking to you on that morning, you were kind of saying, oh, I don't know whether to go to London, I don't know whether to do this. And I think I said the same thing as Andy, like, you don't have to prove anything to anyone. Mm. Like, and I think that's a hard thing, like, I guess for anyone who's motivated in anything, but I guess if you're an athlete or, you know, someone who is sporty, you have a kind of sense of wanting to prove whatever it is, prove stuff to yourself, prove that you can get through it, or prove that you can push through stuff or whatever. And I think you have this added thing of expectation from external sources, whether it's people watching you or people who sponsor you or whatever it is, of like needing to, I don't know, I don't know if performs the right word, but that's kind of what it feels like. And I felt like I needed to say, obviously we are one of your sponsors, but obviously we're very good friends as well. And I feel like I needed to say to you as well, like, just stop. Like no one cares. Honestly, literally, if you just stopped everything and didn't do anything again from this day onwards, it would be fine. You know what I mean? And I think that it's really important to like take a step back from these things and be like, you are a person. Like you can't expect too much from things. Like stuff like this has to be like an inherent risk of just going about life, doesn't it? And yeah, you have to be able to see that like you're a person, you have fragility, like you can only do so much. And I think I could recognize definitely that there was a, you almost needed, I don't know, I felt like you needed someone to tell you you don't have to do it.
Yeah, I did. And I think as I've matured into doing this thing, I'm much better at just going, I don't need to.
And
you know that, having that, we, you know, we are obviously very good friends, but also we have a business relationship as well. And you guys are probably, as a brand, probably the best at understanding that of any brand that I work with, but also as friends, completely understand the importance of the mental health aspect of it and understand that. And I, you know, I reach out to you guys all the time and just chat shit at you. And I think I've, as I've got older, I've more understood this kind of like the fact that I do things for me primarily. It's a challenge for myself. Occasionally when there's external factors in, like with this one, with the film crew, being an external factor who are being paid, their time's being paid to film this and then to edit it, that becomes an annoying, no offense to them, it becomes a bit of an annoying external pressure, because it is that whole kind of expecting to perform kind of thing again. But I think what I have really learned from what happened the first time in a very positive way is how something that's been really important to me with all the brands I'm supported by is, and I think I've always said this to you as well, Emily, is it shouldn't be a me and the brand or the brand and me. It is a partnership, a long-term partnership, and it is creating a friendship with a person at that brand. And so that's very clear. Obviously, with you guys, we've been working together for years now, but Savella is now a couple of years in. That's very much a friendship relationship as well as a working relationship with the people I work with there. It's become the same as Shimano. You know, it's the same with, I'm looking at my bike trying to remember who the sponsors are. It's the same with parkours with the wheels. Dov is a friend, you know, he's probably similar to you and Jimmy. He's a friend first. And this kind of came off as a secondary thing. And then same with like Schwalbe Tires, that very much started as a business relationship. But I, you know, now my main contact in Schwalbe Germany and Schwalbe UK, I would say are friends. You know, I'm always asking for like mountain biking tips and what the fuck to ride on a mountain bike. Not that I have a mountain bike yet, TBC. And it's, you know, that's always been really important to me, that it becomes, these relationships are a long-term thing and they become friend relationships. And one of the things that really, I was really pleasantly surprised of and actually very proud of was the fact that every brand that's a sponsor, the person that I work with reached out to check in that I was okay. Mm. And made a real conscious effort to, whether it was call up, email, write a message, most of them, to be fair, were phone calls, to see how I was, and to basically say very bluntly, we're not putting any pressure on you, it's fine. Yeah. And I didn't expect that, and it was really, you know, massive kudos to every brand, you guys, whoever it is, for kind of going, it's fine.
Mm. No, it's really good to hear. And I think there's like, obviously what you do for work is a very unique case, but I think there's kind of a lesson or a talking point in just about like good workplace culture rather than toxic workplace culture. You know, like probably a lot of people watching work in an environment, hopefully, with people where if they had an issue, there would be some compassion on a human level. You know, I have previously worked for people in what I would call quite a toxic work environment, and definitely been out of my comfort zone and not felt like I had support. And I think, you know, part of this sort of mental health campaign is about feeling open enough to talk about what's going on, whether it is, you know, you have anxiety, or, you know, being able to kind of talk to people in confidence, whether they are friends or work colleagues or whoever, about things that are going on and how that may affect how they go about their work or whatever it is, or there's an incident that's happened and it needs compassion. And that's a really important thing, but it's also important that the workplace cultures are receptive to that, because if you're saying all of this and then they're like, no, it doesn't work. So it's a good example, I guess, of responding to a situation that's out of people's control in a compassionate way. So I think there's something to take away from that, you know, from both sides, I guess.
Yeah, I think similarly to you, when I worked in design and architecture primarily, there was definitely points where I felt as if there was not, and that was a point when I was definitely really struggling with my own mental health, and there was not the support there. And you know me from the latter end of those days, and I was fucking all over the place. And I think that is a lot of that is, unfortunately, is down to that industry. I wouldn't ever name the companies. I don't want to put anyone in a bad light, but unfortunately that was part of that industry. And I think probably similar with your old career, probably part of that industry as well, unfortunately. I'd like to hope that it's getting better, especially now. It feels like even in this, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, since I've started kind of doing this kind of writing and challenges and stuff, it feels like the discussion about mental health and like, you know, how you are in your own self is being much more portrayed in the public light and in the, you know, in the press, in the media. So I'd really like to hope that it's starting to get better. And I also think, like, a younger generation of people in the workforce, our generation and the generations below us, are much more in tune with that than maybe some of the older generations.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's definitely changing, isn't it? It seems to be. I think also just like the other takeaway from it is that, you know, it's almost not being afraid to call it when you're actually at your limit. And again, going back to it, like, I think anyone who has a drive has to push themselves through, like, oh no, don't give up. You know, we're always told, like, no, don't give up, keep going. You have to push to be able to progress, but you have to be able to do that within your comfort zone. And I think it's a hard thing, and it's something that takes a lot of time and sort of understanding and coming to know yourself, knowing what is actually just pushing through a little obstacle to better yourself, and what is actually, no, if I continue on doing this, it's not serving me in any way. It's going to make me feel bad, or it's going to physically hurt me, or whatever it is. I think that's probably a good message to sort of come from someone like you, who, I don't know, I imagine people look up to, and it almost, you know, you do all of these like huge, huge challenges that most of us wouldn't ever dream of being able to do, or just wouldn't have the, you know, it would take so much to get there for you to be able to actually go, you have a limit. You know what I mean? You can respond to external circumstances and say, no, it's fine. Let's stop it as well. I think it's a good takeaway.
I was thinking about this the other day while I was yesterday while I was out on a bike ride. And the other thing that I relate to with this is, with a lot of like long distance things, is the difference between injury and pain. Yeah. And what I mean in that context is, you look at 107 TDF last year, for example. That was a challenge, which was 107 miles over 20 odd days. There's going to be those two things that could be potentials: injury and pain. Injury is something which can do long-term damage. Yeah. Pain is something that's manageable. Yeah. And what I'm saying is that you are inevitably, if you think, if you're working in an office, you're sitting at a desk for 8 hours, whatever it is, you get neck pain, back pain. Yeah, that's part of that. Yeah. Now you think, if you're out riding a bike 8-15 hours, whatever it is, that's your office. Yeah, you're still going to get neck pain, back pain, knee pain, whatever it is, it's still incorporated in that. So and this to me comes down with understanding your body, and the only person that understands your body better than you is you. No one does. You're the person that knows it better than anyone. And being able to understand it so well to know when it's pain, which is like pain that's not actually doing any damage, is what I call like office pain, you know, stiff back, et cetera, et cetera. Which I understand that that can be something that can cause long-term problems. Don't get me wrong. But what I'm saying is there's a difference between pain and injury, and knowing what is each is really, really important. And I think on 107 TDF, for example, there were points where I thought this is close to injury, and you just have to be aware of that and how to manage it as opposed to pain. Because there's pain every day. There just is. It's the nature of riding that kind of distance every day for so bloody long. But you need to know, and that's coming down to your own understanding of your body, your self-control, and that's all tied up into this ability to know when you have to stop and when you should stop.
That takes, I guess, time and practice, isn't it, really? If you're starting out riding, for example, you're probably not going to know the difference. You're not going to know whether things are hurting because actually you need a change of position, or actually that's just, you know, that just hurts and you get used to it. But I actually think you could say the same for the mental health side of things, really. Like, everyone's limit is different. I guess if you think of like a cup, and every experience you're kind of pouring into the cup, and there's a point where everyone's cup becomes too overflowed, and that's kind of where things, I guess, start to become too much. And that's different for everyone, and that experience is going to be different for everyone. So while there might have been someone in that situation where it might not have affected them for as much, for whatever reason, there might be some people who affect them so much that couldn't have carried on. Like, I don't know, I guess the important thing is saying, this did that for me, and this is what it felt like, and this is what I had to do because of it. And knowing that is a very powerful thing, and being able to say to other people, it's okay for that thing to upset you, kind of thing, I think is a powerful message as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, it's something that comes over time, isn't it? You have to learn to know yourself and what, you know, what triggers you and what's just too much and all that stuff.
And it does, as you say, it's a lot of it comes down to experience. And I wouldn't no way say I'm the most experienced at this kind of thing, but I've done enough of it to know mentally and physically how I am. And it comes down to, you know, taking away that, as a bloke, that masculinity. I actually think it's probably makes you a stronger person and more powerful thing to know when to, you know, to be open and honest about a situation like this was. And to me, it's way more powerful and maybe more masculine to be able to go, this fucking scared the shit out of me. That's kind of my stance on it. And as I've sort of said quite a lot, for me, what I hope and I believe has been a bit of a success of it is being able to encourage people to realize that's allowed, and you can be vulnerable. It doesn't matter of your age, sex, height, race, whatever it is. Vulnerability is something that affects everyone and doesn't matter on anything, and it's very individual on how it affects you. It could be you could be scared of woodlice, and there's woodlice coming across the floor. There was one marching across my floor the other day, or this morning, and I think I don't know where he's gone. You could be petrified of them. Their woodlice might make you feel vulnerable. You know, there's so many different contexts of it, and I think what I'm also trying to say is that we as human beings have to understand that everyone is different and everything affects people in a different way. Like you sort of said, it's very individual with the cup, big cup, small cup, whatever it is. And being able to empathize to someone else's situation is something that I don't think we're very good at as people. It comes down to that whole thing about I was talking to someone about this yesterday as well, ironically, privilege and what is perceived as privilege. And like the simplest way of thinking about it in my mind is, if there's something that you don't even second guess doing, but someone else might second guess doing, that's privilege. And what I mean by that, for example, I was talking to my partner about it a while ago, and we were talking about, I wouldn't second think about going outside for a walk in the dark, like go to the shops in the dark, whatever it is. She would.
Mm-hmm.
That's an example of privilege. And that this is where what I'm saying is that whole thing about being able to empathize with someone and understand it from a different perspective is something which is very hard to do, but something that everyone should really make the time and effort to do that as best as you can. It's a tricky, it is tricky, and it will take years and years and years for people to be able to master that kind of thing. I don't actually think you could master it, because you obviously, it's very hard to step in the shoes of another person.
No, it's interesting. It's kind of ironic as well, because I think ultimately, like what you're talking about, like breaking down the stereotypes of masculinity, and obviously that is a very big thing that Movember do. It's kind of, it's a term used a lot, but like toxic masculinity ultimately is what needs to be broken down. And obviously that affects women greatly, but also it affects men as well. You're an example of how that affects men, because ultimately you have been a target of what I would say is probably toxic masculinity. You know what I mean? People who aren't able to empathize, people who, I mean, generalizing here, guessing, but perhaps, you know, why is that their outlet to sort of set upon a person who's kind of minding their own business? You know what I mean? It's just kind of toxic sort of laddie culture, isn't it? And that affects everyone. It doesn't just affect women. It affects everyone.
Yeah. The other thing that, I mean, that whole lab culture thing is something that I don't get it personally. I just don't think it, I've never been a lad, a lad, or whatever we want to say. I just don't get it. But there's like, I'm sure I've said this to you many times. I say this regularly. Something that has always stood out to me, which is something my dad used to say to me as a kid, was treat others how you'd want to be treated. Very blunt, it's a very simple message, but it's got me pretty far in life. You know, basically that translates to don't be a dick, you know, and take it or leave it in whatever context that is, but it's a really important message. Like, I don't want someone, you know, why would I feel comfortable, if it was me, why would I feel comfortable with the idea of intimidating someone? And then would I want that to happen to me? No. Mm-hmm. And, you know, another thing this relates to is when I went to Hong Kong a few years ago, and I was told, I was advised to make sure my tattoos were covered up. And it's a cultural thing. And I was advised because there were concerns that I could be considered to be associated with a gang or a certain gang, which could then cause trouble wherever I was. And I was just like, okay, cool. Trousers and long sleeve shirts. It's not a problem. That's you know, being respectful of what you're being advised on, but also understand, that's also me understanding how I could be seen as intimidating to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Equally as important, you know, equally as important.
Oh, definitely.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Right. I'm going to bring us back slightly onto track again and talk about, I guess that's kind of what happened with the aftermath of the first challenge.
Mm.
The second attempt, I guess, how did that go down? Did it go well? Did it feel like quite a standard ride? I mean, it's not a short distance at all, but it's kind of a short distance for you. So was it kind of like it'll be easy, or was there apprehension? Was there apprehension because of what happened before?
Yeah, I think, so I went into the second attempt probably more relaxed.
Right.
More relaxed than I thought I would be. And I think that was purely down to the fact that, you know, I hadn't really done anything like this since the trenching challenge, which was November, and we were in May. And it's always like the first thing of the year is always, you get nervous about it because you just don't really know quite where your legs are at or anything. And I went into the second attempt a lot more relaxed. And I think that goes down to the fact that I was like, well, I did 400K in 15 hours, but that's good going. And I think there was definitely a lot of apprehension and nerves, and still, even though I was relaxed. And to be honest with you, I didn't feel that nervousness until I was riding. And I think a lot of it was familiarity to start with. It was like, oh, I've ridden this road. I remember this bit. I've got like a ridiculous memory for roads. I always have done. I just remember bits of road. And it's not like I know that challenge was a month ago. It's like a month in between the first attempt and the second attempt. It's not that there's the memory of that. It's the memories of like, oh, I rode this bit of road 6 years ago when I did this, that kind of thing. So it's kind of like a lot of the same again, same business, riding the bike, getting used to it and getting, you know, kind of knuckling down. I rode a different bike on the second attempt, very intentionally because of what I learned from the first one. Now, what I mean is from the first attempt, I rode my Cervelo R3, which was set up with a semi-compact chainrings on the front and an 11-30 on the rear, which I thought would probably be okay. I knew that the first sort of section kind of up to Dartmoor National Park and Exeter Way is pretty brutal. It's pretty undulating, but it's sharp and steep. And I thought semi-compact with the 11-30, that should be enough gears, you know, it should be okay. But what I didn't really take into account is that it's the fatigue of grinding a bigger gear up a climb. Yes, I can ride up a climb like that, but ask me to do it 30 times.
Yeah, shred.
It does really start to knack your legs out. So I chose to ride on my Aspero 5, which is running GRX DI2, which is 11-38 cassette, and then like a 43-30 something. It's like a smaller chain. I can't remember what it is, but it's smaller chain. I'm looking at it and I can't read the writing from here. Anyway, smaller chain rings, bigger cassette. So, but also the largest chain ring is still large enough that on the flats you can pick up some speed. So I thought that's wise, should allow me to be a bit more spinning up some of the climbs. Put the same wheels on, which is a set of Parkour Strada wheels with a 30 mil tire on it. So big fat tire, super comfortable. And the Strada wheels are really wide, so fat tire actually sits really nicely on them. And that was basically it. I decided not to ride clip-on TT bars this time because they were really annoying getting out of the saddle. I think the GRX shifters, the DI2 shifters, are the nicest for me with my tendonitis. They are the nicest shifters to hold, as in I feel like I can grip on them nicely. You can also grip onto the drops and still be able to use the brakes, no problem at all, which is really, really nice. So I kind of took what I learned from the first attempt and tweaked it for the bike. You know, I wore a different helmet, wore the same glasses, same kit made by you guys. I actually wore the actual same bib shorts as I wore the first time.
Nice, lucky ones.
Lucky bib shorts. Obviously, I wore a different jersey because you guys bought out a new jersey, and I remember messaging you going, is this going to be out by this point? Because I really want to wear it. Luckily, it was out. And then the other kind of, what else did I kind of tweak? I ran like a top tube bag, and very intentionally running a chop tube bag is because it's easier to get stuff out of than a bar bag when you're riding. I really like bar bags, and I like bar bags because they don't rub on your knees or anything when you get out of the saddle. But the reason for running a top tube bag was while I'm riding, it's so much easier just to open it up, get stuff out. And I've also got in there battery packs so I can plug in for the phone, for the bike computer, whatever it is. It's all easy to get to for the lights and everything. And then little saddlebag on the back and two water bottles, road pedals on the bike as opposed to gravel pedals. That's basically it. And I felt like the bike was a better choice, much more well suited to the challenge with the gear ratios and stuff. I tweaked the route to get rid of some of the shit bits. So I felt quite relaxed going into it. And what was really nice, I actually had someone join me quite early on, which kind of like settled my mind and a lot of my nerves out of it very quickly. that was really nice. She rode with me for like 2 or 3 hours, I think. So it was nice to have someone just to talk through kind of everything, really. Just have someone to talk to, as a bit of a distraction. And then, you know, the plan always was roughly every 4 hours, which is roughly 100K, give or take, depending on the elevation. Generally 4 hours, stop, get a load of new food, get a load of drink, go again. That was always the plan. I know how to fuel for 4 hours. That's what I do. It's a tried and tested thing with me for like the national 24-hour TTs. I know exactly what I need to do for 4 hours. I know what to eat, when to eat, and how to drink, etc. So that was just the plan. And then I guess like the nerves started creeping in coming in towards Andover a lot more. I think kind of understandably, I rationalized it in my head that this is the act of a few people, which could have happened anywhere, literally anywhere on the route. I intentionally started later on the second attempt because I wanted to go through Andover later. That was a very, very intentional. It was about 2.5 hours later. So instead of going through Andover at like 10 o'clock, I was going to go through there like midnight. That was kind of intentional. And I got to Andover, and I was fucking shitting it. I'll be honest, I was shitting it at that point. I was pretty tired. And Andy and Ed were in the van, basically very close to me the whole way through Andover, because I sort of said to them, like, please, can you make sure you're close? I said, I know the chances of anything happening again are so slim, but I'd really appreciate it just for me, for my own kind of mental stability. And they were like, no problem at all. Got into Andover, and there was a gent and his son on the side of the road waiting to ride through Andover with me.
Oh, that's nice.
That was fucking lovely. I did not expect it. And they were genuinely lovely guys. And they rode with me through Andover until we got through Andover and just talked through, just chatted, really. That was a really... That really got me in the feels that day. It was a really lovely thing to have seen. And then similarly, one of the police officers I was dealing with was working that evening and kind of made a point of, I bumped into him just on the road, and he made a point of, you know, saying hi, checking how I was. Also, really lovely thing to do. And then further down the road, the main... I nearly said sheriff, but that's definitely not the right word. The boss police officer guy. Can't think of it. He was outside with his family, I think a young daughter, wife, and him outside cheering as I rode past. He lived just out north, like closer to London than Andover.
Oh, that's nice.
And those three things were really lovely. It's a really nice thing to see. So I end up carried on riding for quite a bit more, and it's, you know, it's getting to the early hours in the morning and I'm feeling pretty fucked. And I think I've got my mentality's changed slightly in the sense of, like, when I was younger, I would have probably pushed myself way too hard, and made the end of it really shit. Mm. Now, this isn't a race. This is a challenge which is simply about completing it, similar to what the trenching challenge was. If I needed to stop to have a snooze, I was going to have a snooze. And that happened at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, I do not feel particularly safe right now to continue riding. I'm going to have 2 hours and 40 minutes sleep, is what it ended up being, I think. And so pulled over in the van, had a snooze in there for 2 hours and 40 minutes, woke up, got on the bike again. And it was just like, and the reason for doing that was, I was like, this is going to make me feel somewhat fresher for the next, I think I still had like 300K to go at that point. It's wise. Very logical, very wise. 300K with no, doing, you know, nearly 700K with no sleep when you don't need to is just like potential. There's so many potential things that could go wrong. It's a different kettle of fish with like the national 24-hour time dial, because you've only got that 24 hours. But with this, it wasn't a case of necessarily finishing it in a certain time. It was a case of finishing it. So similar to the trenching challenge. I mean, I had a target sort of time. I wanted to do it in under 30 hours total moving time, and I did it in under 30 hours moving time.
Yeah, good. What we're going to do now is you sent me over some questions that you got through your Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
So we can do them as some like quick fire questions.
Yeah.
Okay, Birdman says, best and worst road ridden.
Worst road ridden was a little country lane in Cornwall, and I don't know the name of it. I literally don't know how to find it on Komoot, but I've ridden it 4 times now and I fucking hate it every single time. I've ridden it 4 times because I rode it from on 107 TDF, I rode it down to Land's End. Yeah. I rode it then back up towards John O'Groats, and then I rode it obviously going up it twice for the coast-to-coast ride. Why it's the worst bit of road is because it is 27% at one point, and it is super narrow country lane. Like, it is the width of a small car.
Yeah.
Dirt in the middle, broken tarmac on the sides. Like, it's fucking terrible. And you get out of the saddle and the wheel just starts spinning because it's all gritty and stuff. Now, as I said, I don't know where this is. I don't know where it is, but every time I've seen it, I know the turning at the bottom that goes up to it, and you go over a little bridge and then it's a turning straight after the bridge. So I could probably find it. But every single time, I'm just like, for fuck's sake, it's not pleasurable and it's quite long. But you'd be going up it for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
That's the worst bit of road.
What's the best?
Best bit. This time round, I really enjoyed riding the roads around like Norfolk. And I didn't... Last time I rode around there was in 107, and I really didn't enjoy it because it was brutal headwind the whole way.
Yeah, yeah.
But this time it was still a bit headwindy, but it was a lot calmer. And it's quite nice because it just undulates along. It's quite nice. It's not really much climbing. It's nice and smooth. The road surfaces are very, very good. Really good, actually. So that was probably the best bit, I would say. Perfectly honest, there was a lot of shit bits of road, but yeah, they were probably the highlights and the lowlights, I'd say.
Okay. What's this person called? Tim Zegstrew asks, how do you go about resting and how rested are you actually after a stop? So you kind of mentioned that you had like a little sleep and stuff. Are you having stops in between that? And how are you actually rested, or are you just kind of...
So normally as I say, I break these kind of things down into 4-hour blocks. And the reason why is I think that it's quite easy to carry enough food and water for 4 hours. Like, you can do that quite easily. For me, what that equates to is I use Martin in my water bottles, which is quite good for getting additional carbohydrate in. Other brands do the same thing, but the Martin stuff works for me because it's just doesn't upset my stomach. So 2 big Martin things in my water bottles. So it's called a 360. At nighttime, I use one with caffeine. In the daytime, I don't. And then 2 gels. Generally, I use Martin gels as well. Same thing. Don't disagree with me. But I do mix it up every now and then with whatever I've kind of got lying around. And then 2 bar-y things. And so this can be, I've like bought a load of Velo Forte bars in the past, which work quite well for me, but specifically like the citrusy ones, because it just isn't sweet. It's a bit of different taste. But as I say, this can be, when I say bar-y things, I mean, it could be a Velo Forte bar. It could be a freaking, a rice cake that I've made. I made some sweet and savory ones, which I will eventually at some point do something with the full recipes on how to do them. They're really easy. It could be a couple of roast potatoes. Could be a flapjack that I made, because I made like quite citrusy flapjacks. That website is on Will Gerling's website. That recipe is on Will Gerling's website if anyone wants to see it. The only thing I do differently is I do orange and lemon zest in it, as well as fresh lemon juice. It's the only thing I do differently. So it's a bit more zesty. So you can carry enough of this.
Those at rest stops, are you?
Pardon?
You're having those at rest stops every 4 hours.
So I'm recollecting all that food.
Oh, I see. Right. Yeah.
Have on me, because you eat that while you're riding for the 4 hours. And then in these stops where I'm refilling, after these like 4 hours of riding, depending on, generally speaking, I don't really stop for long. It's like 5 minutes. It's normally a case of like, refill the pocket, have a chat with the guys filming, because they want to just see how I am with the cameras and stuff. And then normally, to be honest, I normally end up drinking a water bottle while I'm there, and then have two fresh ones on the bike, and then go again. So really, I mean, I might be sitting down in the back of the van while I'm doing all this stuff, but really, I'm not really resting in those kind of periods. It's more of a case of just, for me, it's normally like, I need to think, I need to do this. I might be doing sitting down. And obviously later on, these stops were getting a bit longer, and I would be taking my shoes off, for example, just to give my feet a bit of thing. And then, especially in the sun, because it was very hot and very sunny, I'm having to reapply sun cream every 4 hours, basically. So that adds to the, while I'm doing that, I'm sitting down, taking my shoes off, rolling my socks down to do it all. So that adds up a bit of time. But it's not really rest. It's just time off the bike. The only bit I class as rest is that 2 hours and 40 minutes at like 4 o'clock in the morning, when I was like, I don't think it's safe to continue riding.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have a little bit of a power nap and then continue riding. That's the only bit I class as rest. And that, to be perfectly honest, can be at any point on these kind of challenges. It could have been at midnight. It could have been at 6 o'clock in the morning. It changes. It really does change.
Okay, here's another one from Chloe H24. Says, do you get saddle sores and how do you deal with them?
I do get saddle sores. They are the burden of my life, as I think they are for a lot of people. How do I deal with them? I have tested a hell of a lot of saddles, and I think I've found the best so far. I'm not going to say it's perfect, but it's probably the best I've found so far, which for me is, it's the Pro Stealth 152 width. I think it's 152. It's the best that I've found so far. I've used various different versions of this saddle. They do different widths. They do different, there's like a carbon one, an aluminium one, or a gravel one. And I actually think I prefer the gravel one the most, because it's slightly thicker padding, and it's the cutout is filled in. But it still has a cutout, if that makes sense, in it. So my biggest tip with saddle sores, to be perfectly honest, is you need to just try loads of saddles to try and find the best of what you can find. The best way to do that is don't buy a load of saddles. Go to a bike fitter and literally go through everything they've got. That's what I did. Turned up in this saddle. There are some saddles which generally... a lot of bike fitters will say that you quite often, these are the saddles that work for most people. That is Specialized Roman, Specialized Mimic, Specialized Power Saddle, the Pro Stealth Saddle, Bontrager's Saddle. That's generally the saddles that work for most people. You'll notice if you look at these saddles, they all pretty much look very similar. Short nose, cut out in the middle, very similar sort of styling. The Roman's probably the longest of the lot.
I have a physique that's like that as well. The new, I can't remember, it's like Argo or something like that. It's exactly the same as that, cut out and short.
Yeah, so Physique have now started doing them as well. I've not tried any of their newer saddles, so I can't speak for what they're like. I know the older saddles I didn't get on with, but I think as a brand, they've really invested a lot into the development of their saddles in the recent years. So there's loads of options. The best thing I can say is go to a bike fitter. The next thing is what I do. And I've tried lots of different chamois creams as well. And I've kind of settled on maybe two brands. There is different saddle creams for men and women, first of all. Very important to note is to do with your body's natural pH levels, that some will disagree with you, cause rashes and stuff, and some will agree more with you. So be very aware that there's different options for men and women on chamois cream. I've kind of settled on two brands that I seem to use. One of them, and basically it's normally a case of what I can get hold of is what I choose. The one that I've been liking the most is by Premax, which is an Australian company. They do men's and women's versions, and it's just, it's also got like a slight, it's not like antibiotic-ishness to it, but it feels like it's clean, if that makes sense. Sounds kind of weird to say. The other one that I do quite like, and annoys me to say it because it's fucking expensive, is the Asos one. But a lot of people don't like that because it's almost mentally. I like it because for some reason in my head, I feel like it's like more antibacterial than one that's not. Now what I'm sort of saying here is the Premax one is probably one that I prefer because I think it's, there seems to be more, the guy that set up Premax is like a physio guy called Randall Cooper. And he's like, he just seems to be, he's very open about the experimentation and the testing and the development of products. And that to me is what appeals to that brand. The Asos one hasn't changed in a very long time. And I know a lot of people don't like that one because they feel it's like tingly and everything. And in theory, the best thing to do, to be perfectly honest with these kind of things, is to try different brands and see what kind of works for you. Don't try it on long distance rides, try it on short stuff. And then the bit that I do, you know, saddle sores, unfortunately, are kind of part of cycling. For me, after a long ride like this, to be perfectly honest, I just don't ride a bike for a while to let my body calm down. It's normally a week. And as kind of weird as it sounds, is moisturizing around your sores, like making sure the skin's okay, like looking after it, salt baths, that kind of thing really, really helps. Unfortunately, it is part of the nature of the sport. And to me, the key things is bike fit, testing out saddles, testing out chamois cream.
Mm-hmm. Adam Bradford says, what torque setting should you use when checking your nuts?
Check on the specific torque setting on your nuts themselves. Depends on the bike. 3 to 5 Newton meters.
No, but seriously, I think on, is it on Movember's website somewhere? They have a thing about how to check your nuts, don't they?
Yeah, so on a serious note, if you do go to Movember's website, there's a very, very good thing. It's called, I think it's movember.com/nuts and bolts. And it talks about how to check your nuts properly. It's like having a nice hot shower, make them nice and loose, have a good feel around. And you should do it like once a week, really, just to see if there's anything a bit doesn't feel quite right and the same. And as you start to understand your nuts a bit more, you'll very easily notice things that aren't quite right and little changes that don't feel quite right. But there's so many good resources out there. As I say, movember.com/nuts and bolts is one that's a fantastic resource for it.
And if you do feel anything that you're not, even if you're not sure it might not be anything, you should just go and talk to your GP, get it checked.
Exactly. Go straight to your GP, get it checked out. You're better to have it checked out and it be nothing than not checked out and, you know, a couple of weeks, months, whatever down the line, it becomes quite serious.
Yeah, cool. And then Lou says, not a question, just wanted to say you're so brave and awesome to go again, mate. Respect and love, which is nice.
Yeah, love Lou. She's a good egg.
She's a good egg. Cool. Yeah. I guess the last thing is, you were obviously doing this to raise awareness, but also Movember has a donation page as well, don't they, if people wanted to donate?
Yeah, so what I'll do is I'll put the link to the donation page in the description of this video, because I literally think it's something like movember.com/some random numbers and stuff. But it's all, I'll put the link below so that people can donate if they'd like to. Obviously, like I've always stressed, if you're not in a situation that you're not able to donate, that's absolutely fine. Being able to share and discuss this kind of thing openly, or equally finding a cause that's important to you and doing something to support them, that's also incredible. If you are able to donate, thank you very much. Thank you to everyone that has donated. It's like the money genuinely does go very far in helping this kind of thing. And it's not just the support you're providing to the charities who are doing the kind of research on testicular cancer, but also is support for things like training and educating people, and also being able to help out with counselors and stuff for the mental health side of it, because that's a big financial commitment for a lot of charities, quite similar to Movember and for what Movember do as well.
Cool. Okay. Is there anything else you
want to
say before we go?
Always be prepared. Always be prepared in these situations. The one thing I get asked a lot is, what do you do when you need to go to the toilet? Yeah. And someone asked me this as well, and I haven't answered it because it's a story involving this. So we were riding during this challenge. Obviously, as a guy, if you need to go for a piss, it's pretty easy. If you need to go for a shit, it's a different nature. Yeah. And if you're a woman, obviously it's a frustrating thing. You've got to squat out, yeah?
Find someone to squat.
Exactly. If you're a guy and need a shit, you've got to squat it out as well. And during the second attempt, the problem I find is you're eating so much and obviously you're burning so many calories, but you do get to this point where you're like, fuck, I just feel really bloated. And I got to that point and had to go and squat one out in the middle of the woods. And,
on this challenge?
Yeah. And the film guys were like, are you being serious? And I'm like, 100%. Going right now. They're going into that woods and finding somewhere. And a nature poo. It's one of the best things in the world. Like, if you haven't done it, go and do it this summer. Go have a nature poo.
So do you have to carry toilet roll with you? Do you carry a spade so you can dig it up? You can make one back?
On this situation, I didn't have a spade on me. I did have baby wipes, so they became the toilet roll, so to speak. In things like Atlas Mountains and stuff, have a toilet roll, take a toilet roll, literally took one. And the other thing is toilet roll, baby wipes, and antibiotic like hand cream stuff afterwards, which I think now most people are carrying all the time anyway, but like, do that and just make sure it's a bit of a private area and you'll be fine.
I would say I would also add to that, take either dog poo bags or baby nappy sacks or something so you can take all your waste with you as well.
That's a good point. I didn't have that. So I'm sorry.
For next time.
Sorry, people in the woods. I don't think many people have been going for that bit of woods, thankfully, because it was hard to walk through as it was. The ironic thing is I thought I'd left my sunglasses in the woods. And I was having a bit of a panic when I got back to the van, and then Ed was like, oh, these ones. And I was like, yes, thank fuck. Okay.
Nice.
Anyway, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate that I've taken your time for like fucking hell, quite a long time.
No, that's okay.
And
I've got a little dog sitting outside here who's just waiting to get back in because you're not being allowed.
Face like, let me in.
Yeah, you're just screaming every so often.
Oh, bless her. So give Bella my love. Give Jimmy my love as well. Thank you for, as always, helping out with these kind of things. I think it's just really good as a way to talk through kind of what happened, especially like this one and the previous ones where there's been a lot to talk about. And it's helpful as a way of sharing the story and helping to talk about it, even though I know there's a film coming out of it all, but that's not going to come for a while. It's a really good opportunity to try and keep that discussion going and supporting good causes. So I really appreciate it. If you don't know Atticus, please go and check out their website. What's the website?
It is www.atticus.cc.
Go and check it out. They do amazing kit. They are my friends, and we've not only done some really cool collaboration kits together, they make fucking great kit, and there's more great stuff coming. So go and look and buy and support, because it's fucking cool. Plug.
Thank you very much.
Plug, plug, plug. Little electric plug. One of these plugs, all the plugs. Anyway, thank you. Have a really good rest of your day. Say hello
to you. You too. Yeah, enjoy it. Rest up, and hopefully you're feeling back to normal soon. You're getting there, aren't you?
Yeah, see you next week.
Yeah, see you next week.